welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It seems as if Americans have never before been involved in a situation where every day brings a loud new threat to our public order and to our commonwealth. Our executive branch demands our scrutiny on a daily, even hourly basis. We watch as America and much of the world grows increasingly polarized, and in the din of this polarization, the truth gets drowned out. Today, we're joined by Portland poet and essayist Wendy Willis, whose new book of essays, These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic, expresses the dismay, horror, and fear and wonder that so many of us face in this age of Trump and the resistance. Wendy, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to start by talking about three themes that I really found throughout your book. And the first one is resistance. Your first chapter is about the resistance. And then there's the whole thing of drowning out the truth. And then the third one has to do with this invasion of privacy, basically, and the increased surveillance and the increased way in which our lives are being taken over by, as some of my friends call it, the machine.
Yes.
So you wrote a number of essays that cover these issues. And what I found actually interesting, when I started reading your book, I thought, this is all post-Trump, because your first chapter kind of sounds like, after Trump was elected, everything changed, and I stopped writing poetry, and I just have been a polemicist ever since. and then as I started thumbing through it, I realized a lot of these essays were from much earlier, well, 2 or 3 years before Trump became president. And that, in fact, there was kind of a foreshadowing in those of what has come since November 2016. So I wanted to kind of frame that as we talk about the truth, resistance, and surveillance, about how you saw, in retrospect, I guess, as you were putting the essays together for this book, that we, if we'd really looked closely, would have seen this coming long before Trump got elected.
Yeah, that's right, Barbara. I mean, and I think, of course, many people, including a lot of people of color, told us they were not surprised by Trump's election because, you know, that there were, you know, people who are in vulnerable situations have been feeling this kind of building repression for a long time. And I think I started really, I mean, I will say, I'm the first to say that I said, no, Trump's not going to win. And when my kids asked me about it, like, what are we going to do if Donald Trump becomes president? I kept saying he's not going to become president. So I don't feel like I had any sort of psychic insight into that. But I think if we look back at it, we can see a kind of shimmery repression starting to happen. And I started getting really interested in the role of Google and now, you know, of course, Amazon and Facebook and Twitter. And you realize that, you know, just like with so many things in our life, we try to say it's about our behavior. It's about what we put on Twitter, what we put on Facebook, what we reveal to the world. And you start to realize that it doesn't matter. In some ways, it's so institutional, it's so large that these the machine, you know, if we get gas, if we walk down the street, and if we use our debit cards, if we are on a public university campus, we're going to be seen. And the question then is, what are we going to do about that as a society? And so I think turning it in on ourselves constantly and saying, well, if we just didn't use Twitter, then we would have privacy back is sort of a fallacy.
Well, one of the things that I've been really recognizing in the work that I'm doing, and I'm doing a lot of work around frack gas issues now, that we are tied into all these institutions, some of it for convenience, some of it by necessity. I mean, our house is completely 100% natural gas heated cooking and hot water heater. And that was a really great choice to make in 1993,
yeah.
Before fracking was really abundant. But so if we went without gas, we would not be able to survive very well in the current situation. If we were to try something else, it would be too exorbitant. On the other hand, there's the convenience of Amazon, the convenience of Facebook, which I don't understand, and the convenience, I guess, of Twitter. And I think that people really need to maybe think about a little less convenience. And I guess for somebody my age, I went through a long period of my life where you didn't have this kind of instant feedback, this instant communication, this instant way to reach thousands of people about your birthday party or something. That's part of our responsibility, I think, to look at that. At the same time, that we also have to be scrutinizing it from the other side and figure out how to get these people out of our hair.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think, you know, oftentimes the debate is framed between its security and privacy, and really, I think the real division is between convenience and privacy. And security sounds better. It sounds more defensible, right? That keeping ourselves safe is more important than individual privacy. But in fact, a lot of the decisions that we're making individually have to do with convenience. And I don't want to be too critical about that either. I mean, I think, my parents are both suffering a health crisis right now, and they're pretty much at home all the time. And so things like Amazon or ordering groceries online is keeping their independence.
But there are alternatives to Amazon. Yes. I mean, that's one place that I really worked on that. I've weaned myself totally off of Amazon.
Yes.
And in fact, when somebody tells me about a really great movie that's on Amazon Prime, I say, I don't do that. I'll have to miss that movie. But I'm thinking about back when in the old days when we did email.
Yeah.
And that I would try to explain to people how they could send bulk emails and that you don't have to go on Facebook to like let all your friends know. And it seemed like it was just too hard for people to wrap their brains around how you figure out how to do an address, whatever, a list of people, or I forget what you call it anyway. But, you just put a whole bunch of emails together in a address book, and then you just send them all in one swoop. And that was the time when I realized that this is like where people really don't want to know very much how to do things. They want to find, and that's what Facebook has been so effective at, is like taking away our ability to do things by ourselves and just have Mark Zuckerberg do them for us. I wonder how we get back to that place where we can really assess, well, do I need this much convenience? Mm-hmm. I mean, with your parents, it's a different thing. Though, I mean, and I think the groceries online, there are many different places that can do it that I think are a lot more benign than Amazon.
But don't get me wrong, they're using Fred Meyer. So.
Good old Freddy's. Yeah. So I think that that's a thing of kind of for us to reflect on what are we doing for sheer convenience and not because it's really necessary.
Yeah. I think those are questions one that needs to ask oneself, right? And I think one of the things that's interesting for me, one of the things about this book was, I know as things were building toward what seemed to be kind of a crisis, I started feeling like keeping our own sense of right action is really important. And I'm really reluctant to tell everybody else what their right action should be, and just to say, let's try to create enough internal space for ourselves that we can discern our own moral center. Because I think there's a kind of narcissist in the White House, which, of course, narcissists make it very hard to hear one's own moral code. But I also think, in addition to that, there's just so much incoming to us all the time, both from people we agree with and disagree with, that's really hard to kind of keep our internal voice intact. And so that's something that I think is important in all these decisions, right? The smallest decision about what I'm going to, how I'm going to show up for my kids in the morning to, how I'm going to get my groceries or, how I'm going to heat my house or whatever whatever the example is.
One of the things I really like in your book is you take sort of things that particularly we on the left take for granted, like the resistance, and you put it into a larger context, or you look at it from a variety of ways. And so I wanted to talk about your whole take on the resistance and how, let's say, the pros and the cons of us forming that resistance right after November 2016.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I was the first one to, use the expression, so I'm not judging anybody about this, but it does put the repressor in the middle. So, I mean, I think in a way, by talking about resistance, it's always about relationship with whoever it is that and whatever it is, whatever force it is that we're resisting. And throughout the book, I talk about Václav Havel, who I love and is one of my dear heroes.
Just for people who don't know, who is
so him? Václav Havel was a very well known playwright in what became the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia at the time, and then became sort of radicalized as the Soviet-influenced government was repressing. First of it was rock and roll music, which Václav Havel had zero interest in personally, but then it became artists and writers were the target of the government, which is obviously really common. And so he wrote an essay that was handed around throughout the Soviet bloc, and in that he talks about the idea of one acting, living in truth, So living out of one's own sense of truth is actually, in fact, the best form of resistance. And it may or may not have anything to do with this repressive government. And so there's a kind of life force to it that doesn't mean I'm in opposition all the time. It may be that the thing that gives me spirit and moral certainty is growing a garden. And that if that's your thing, that in fact is a very really powerful form of resisting a repressive government, because what the repressive government wants you to do is be in response to them.
Well, you also make a point about resistance can take a bunch of different meanings, like resistance to disease, like building up your immune system.
Yes.
And I thought that was a kind of interesting way to look at resistance.
Yeah. And that all happens before you're exposed, right? And so thinking about what if we looked at resistance as being, you know, disease resistant? And what are the steps that we could have taken over the years to be resistant to a sort of tyrannical influence? And what are the steps that we can take now that may seem unrelated to what's happening in our community or our political atmosphere, that make us able to discern what's true and what's not true, that make us able to make choices that are consistent with our own moral center, that make us resilient? I think about it a lot in terms of neighborhoods, right? Like resistance to all kinds of negative influences can be, it's not just you and your immediate household, but how does your neighborhood become more resilient in the face of influences that we don't even know what they are yet?
Well, and I've been thinking myself, and just about everybody I know in the last couple of months has had this horrible cold that took weeks to get over.
Me too.
Yeah, we can just spend the rest of the time talking about our cold. But but one of the things I was thinking about, and a lot of the people I know, I mean, well, a lot of my friends are activists, but I felt like we're all worn down, mm-hmm. and when I talked to several people who've had the same cold and kind of figuring out why was it so bad this year, and then it makes me think about this friend who was talking about, she was in a circle of activists, and they were talking about how they took care of themselves under all this stress, and one of them said, I work and work and work until I hurt myself. Another one said, I work and work and work until I get really sick. And I thought, that's not taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, it isn't, And it doesn't serve anybody, but it's so hard not to feel. My dentist told me actually that over the last couple of years, all kinds of people are grinding their teeth down to the point.
My dentist said the same thing.
and it makes you realize that the ambient stress of people is intense. And I think some of it's conflict. Some of it's economic insecurity, it's climate change, there's so many things to worry about, and we're so exposed to it all the time that everybody is, as you say, unwell.
And just tuning in, we're joined by Portland poet and essayist Wendy Willis, author of a new book of essays called These Are Strange Times, My Dear, and you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. I wanted to talk about truth next, because we talked about Havlov, and I'd like to kind of get into that whole thing about mm-hmm. how it feels like truth is really getting drowned out. And this is something, I mean, I've been aware of this for 40 years, more than that probably, ever since in 1976, I watched the mainstream media make Jimmy Carter president. They basically elected him, and it was the first time I saw that whole thing being worked out. And I didn't have, I mean, better him than Gerry Ford, but it really disturbed me that I could see that happening. Since then, I've been much more aware of all these forces that drown out the truth. Mm-hmm. And in fact, of course, the most obvious one is Fox News now. But how do you see that we can get, how do we drown out the drowners out of the truth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there's such huge forces, right? And well-funded forces that actually make confusion is their business. And one of the things I think is interesting is there's a kind of counter force against shame right now. Some of the work of Brené Brown and others talking about the fact that, you know, that shame is a deterrent to creativity. But I think in some sense, shame is also the thing that keeps us closer to the truth, right? So as I think about what is the difference now, I mean, in my lifetime, you know, what's the difference now in terms of what's being said in public and what was said when I was a younger person is there's no shame in lying. Like people will lie directly to your face or to directly to the face of millions of people and feel no shame over it. And that makes it really hard both to stop it, because when it's called out, it doesn't matter. You can just move on, right? And it also makes it really hard to read, because I think we've learned to look for shame signals to tell us when someone's telling the truth or not. And if there's if the lying is shameless, it's really hard to discern whether it's true or not true. And so I think that's for me, seeing that as a real change. I think there have been shameless forces, but now we're seeing human bodies who are lying without shame to us, and it's very confusing in how to respond to that.
Well, actually, I kind of think that might be shifting a little bit. I'm thinking about all the hordes of people being indicted by Robert Mueller in Trump's circle, and like Michael Cohen. I think we're seeing shame in him, and on the other hand, Paul Manafort was. It's a whole other thing. He takes a plea deal and then he lies to Mueller. So I think he is really shameless. And then watching the whole spectacle with Roger Stone getting arrested last Friday, I think is also kind of an indication. I mean, he on the one hand comes across as the ultimate shameless person, and yet in watching him on Friday, I started thinking, I am seeing shame here. He's falling apart.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. So my orientation as a lawyer is I was only ever a criminal defense lawyer. I never practiced any other kind of law than that. And so I find myself deeply concerned about relying on the FBI and the Department of Justice to be our moral enforcers, because that's a power. That's again putting ourselves in the hands of the powerful. And so, I mean, I understand the impulse to root for the FBI under these circumstances, because they're under attack and institutions are being drowned by criticism and lies and all of that. But I also think just being super, super careful about our love relationship with the police, the Department of Justice, and the FBI and the CIA and generals and all the other people who wield power in the culture.
Well, actually, I was thinking back when I was in college, and I lived in this rather hot collective. And I mean, we had the FBI come to our door a few times.
I'm sure.
And we had this whole thing. You learned this protocol of what to do when the FBI came to your door, which you don't talk to them, don't let them in. And I never thought of the FBI as my friends. It was interesting to watch them to be under attack, along with some people that I really respect. Now, on the other hand, someone like Robert Mueller, I think he is a great role model right now he's very good at what he's doing. He really seems to have integrity, and he doesn't leak.
Yeah. And doesn't say anything.
Right. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing. And so I think that there are, as much as the FBI is hard for me to love, the CIA I could never love, but there are, the person I'm most excited about who's running for president is a former prosecutor and attorney general of California. So I think that there's ways in which we maybe can see a little bit more broadly about these, that even these people that we might have seen as representatives of the power structure are more nuanced as well.
I agree with that as individuals. Like, I mean, it is very hard for me to jump in behind a prosecutor as a president. I mean, as much as I really admire her, and she did a great job this weekend, but I also think it's not the individuals, because, of course, there's always been people with integrity in those systems. And it's the thinking that the response to tyrannical power is strong men. And I find that to be concerning. I mean, I think Robert Mueller has tons of integrity. I admire him. I think he was an unbelievably genius choice for that particular position. But it's still, it's set up this dynamic of one strong man against another strong man. And I think that's a dynamic that if you have to choose between those two things, there's an obvious choice, right? But thinking through, what does it mean? How do we create a kind of networked sense of power that undermines that dynamic?
But I think about attorney generals. I mean, a lot of our heroes these days are these Democratic state attorney generals, or their state attorneys general, and they're doing really great work, they are doing it on behalf of all of us.
Yeah.
So again, and I guess I've never really thought of an attorney general as necessarily being a powerful, power-gathering, mongering person. I think it really depends on who they are. And there have been, attorney generals in U.S. attorney generals who have done really good things as well.
It's true. Yeah. Although they are overseeing mass incarceration in this country.
Yes, it's true, too.
Yeah, but no, but I agree with you. I mean, again, I'm not necessarily suggesting that there's not tons of people with integrity in those systems, because there are and there always have been.
Well, I sort of wanted to talk about things that happened since your essays came out, because as bad as things were in 2017, I think that really things really came to the fore last year.
Yeah.
And the first thing that I'm thinking about is the family separations at the border. Yeah. And if you were to write an essay now about that, what would it sound like?
Yeah, I think, I think those family separations really showed us who we are, right? The fact that and not just one person could preside over that, but hundreds of people were having to take steps to separate children from their parents at the border. And the fact that very few or no people stepped in to say this is something that can't stand, it really reveals something about ourselves.
Now, wait, are you talking about, because a lot of people are opposing it, but you're talking about people in the government
itself. That's right, people who are enacting the separations, right? Like, it doesn't... Yeah. It's not a single individual who's enacting those separations. It's hundreds of people who are enacting those separations.
That's the way the Nazis work, too.
Yeah. And so I think that is I keep thinking about the number of people who have to have taken a step for that to happen. And I think that's a really concerning and, you know, horrifying thing. And I think we also have to recognize that separating kids and families has been a tactic around the world, as you say, but also in the United States over time, and that we have to make a decision that that's not who we're going to be.
Now, can you think of any other time in American history? Well, actually, one jumps to my mind immediately, which is sending Native American kids to boarding schools.
Yeah, that's the big one.
But even the Japanese incarceration, they kept the families together.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to think of some other time other than the way we treated Native Americans, which is kind of on the bottom of the way people can relate to each other. Because I had some interesting conversations with people back in June when it was going on, and they ranged from being this Native American elder in Tacoma who was basically using that, I think, as an example of all the other indignities that America has foisted on people, particularly Native American people, to this guy who works for the Port of Tacoma. And I'd been doing an interview with the Port Commissioner and with him, and we finished the interview, and he knew that I was, I think they called me more environmentally leaning, whatever, that's some name for me. But he asked me after the interview what I thought about. First, he asked me if I thought that civic discourse in this country was like really at a low point, and I said, yeah, definitely. And then we got into talking about the family separations, and he started talking about how it was the Gestapo. He felt like the ICE was the Gestapo, and he was going on about how immoral it was. And it turned out this guy is a Pentecostal Christian, and he's very conservative Christian, but he found like this was a violation of every one of Jesus' teachings. Mm. So I came away from that conversation thinking, it's interesting how someone as diverse as the Native American elder had the same response to this. It says something about the ways that people also rise up, or their moral level they get more in touch with their own inner morality when faced with something as horrible as the family separations.
Yeah, but why didn't that play out in ICE itself or in the Department of Homeland Security or at each place that those decisions were made? I agree with you. And I do, obviously the other example of this, just to go back to your original question, is, you know, of course, enslaved people were separated from families all the time. And I guess ostensibly that was in private households, not by the government, but the government obviously allowed that to happen. And the Native kids separated from their families both across North America, both in the United States and in Canada. But I
also was done in Australia.
Was it done in Australia?
Yeah, the movie Rabbit Proof Fence is about because there's the young Aborigines would be separated from their families and go to boarding schools so they could be trained to be domestic servants and things like that.
Really? I didn't know that, actually.
All those English-speaking former British colonies.
Apparently, yeah, right.
Yeah, well, I mean, I found that did really, I agree with you about ice. In fact, I spent a couple days during that time outside of the ICE facility in Tacoma, which is it's a federal detention center.
Yes.
And meanwhile, there was a big occupation happening in Portland, but that's just an office.
Yeah.
And that was really pretty remarkable occupation, actually. But in Tacoma, I went up the first night I was there. It just started. The Portland occupation was about 2 days old. And there were maybe 30, 40 people making a lot of noise and showing solidarity to people inside. But the hostility that we would get from those ICE employees that'd be coming and going and trying to run us down when we're standing outside in the street was really chilling. And I really got a sense of just how divorced these ICE employees are from their own humanity.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, presumably many of them are going home to their own kids, right? Where I think for me, because I have kids at home, it's just so hard to not go, this is our situation. And it shouldn't be that you have to have a child at home to imagine it. But if you can't imagine it otherwise, you know, seeing your own children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews or whoever and imagining them alone and incarcerated.
Now, do you think that beside the wonderment about how people who were employees of ICE and Homeland Security could just go along with this, did you see that there was maybe a spark of awareness amongst everyday people in America that this is something that has really crossed a line?
I mean, from my conversations, similar to yours, I think I had conversations with people who had voted for the president and considered themselves to be, you know, concerned about immigration or whatever, who thought that had gone too far, and you know, now of course we're finding out that it had gone much further than we even knew, and so I do think that is pretty broadly seen as unacceptable behavior.
Because I'm sort of looking, maybe grasping at straws, looking for turning points, but that seemed to me a real turning point. Before that, it really seemed like Trump was kind of getting away with everything he did. There'd be a little bit of protest, but not anything really significant. But that, when I talked to that guy from the Port of Tacoma, I felt like, okay, this is people from a much broader political range are having a reaction that is the same as mine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think, and just watching how quickly they, that Racy's, you know, or I think that's how you say the organization in Texas, raised money to try to quickly file lawsuits, and that happened really fast, within, you know, days of it becoming public, really.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Portland poet and essayist Wendy Willis, author of a new book of essays called These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic. Well, the other thing that seemed to really cut a swath across the sensibility of the American public has been the government shutdown, which is temporarily over. And how do you see... I mean, what lessons do you think are coming out of the government shutdown? And do you think that it's making Americans more empathetic with each other? Because there was the ripple effects of that were pretty large.
One of the things there's all kinds of things we could say about the breakdown of institutions, and that stuff's all been said, and we can talk about that, too, if you want to talk about it.
Sure, let's talk about everything. We got a half hour still.
But I think that the other thing that I thought was interesting about it is, partially this was how the media covered it, suddenly the government started showing up as individual families who were dependent on these jobs. And just the number of stories that were about, you know, this man lives 40 miles from the airport and he's an air traffic controller and his wife is in cancer treatment, or, you know, this family has two members of the family who work for the Forest Service and they're completely dependent on the federal government and they have, you know, two kids in college and a kid in high school. And just the humanization of what seemed to be systems, I think, was very interesting. I think it's an outcome that I didn't see in other shutdowns, probably because they weren't long enough to really pinch in the same way. So I wonder, over time, what that's going to mean for how people look at the government and whether there's waste in government. Because suddenly the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is made up of individual families and people in a different way.
Well, it seems like there were people in the Trump administration, particularly Stephen Miller and a couple other strange human beings, who actually saw the shutdown as a good move towards eliminating government, and that we've been hearing from the right for so long that the government is bad and the government's too big and we should shrink. Oh, that guy, Grover Norquist, yeah. He said, "We want to shrink the government to being such a small size we can drown it in the bathtub." Do you think that this government shutdown made people realize that the government is us?
Well, and that the government is necessary, right? I mean, just my husband flew on Thursday, so the government was still shut down.
And that was the day before LaGuardia and Newark was shut down.
Yes, it was the day before LaGuardia was shut down. And so we took him to the airport, and hardly anyone was there. It was he was sort of had to go because there was a medical emergency. And it was, I think people were like, wow, the government is what's keeping these planes safe. And so I think both that these are our neighbors, right, and that they're just working people, many of them, but also that there are things that we, in some ways, government's become invisible, and it's become so enmeshed with the market that we don't even know what functions are private and which ones are public anymore. That I think it was a way of making visible some things that people really rely on in their day-to-day life. There's all these, of course, I'm sure you've heard all these stories about focus groups where, you know, the focus group leader will say to a group of American, you know, what does government do for you? And people cannot name what government does for them.
It's like, get your government hands up on Medicare.
Yeah. And so just to prompt people to go, well, what about the roads? What about the schools? And I think in some ways, because the shutdown went on so long, it kind of made those fissures more visible to all of us who are, you know, busy and going about our lives and feeling like government doesn't have anything to do with me.
Well, I thought about this a lot, that during the last government shutdown, the only thing that really affected me was I'm kind of a weather geek, and I like to check out the National Weather Service Portland climate data.
Oh, yeah.
And I check it out every few days to see how our water's doing and stuff like that. So I had noticed this last year when there was a government shutdown. That website wasn't working. And this time I actually went a little bit deeper, and I wasn't just like, oh, I'm being inconvenienced because I can't find out what the rainfall is for this month.
Yeah.
I realized I went actually to the climate button on the National Weather Service, and that's where it explained that the entire part of that website was shut down because the government shut down. And I thought, oh, the climate page. And then I heard a report the other day about all this climate data that's not being it's not available.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's disastrous that this stuff, I mean, I'm not even sure if they were taking this data while the government was shut down. So this sort of brought me into a whole other thing about this. I mean, we're in this climate crisis. And one of the things that the Trump administration has done as much as possible is to eradicate any traces about information about climate change or dealing with climate change mm-hmm. from all the government websites. So that was the only part of the National Weather Service that was shut down, was the climate part.
Really?
I think. I didn't check every single button. But, I mean, they were keeping the forecasts.
Yeah.
The farmers need the forecasts.
Yeah.
But, and there are several other things. But climate, let's just get rid of thinking about climate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have to say, a couple of times during the shutdown, I thought, this would be a very bad time to have an earthquake.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what if everybody, you know, if everybody at the national level is furloughed, what's our level of preparedness if something catastrophic were to happen, not just here, but anywhere in the country?
Well, the other part that the media did a very good job of covering and kind of reminded me that it's tax time. And actually, I woke up in the middle of the night one time. I have to order 1099 forms and 1096 for our nonprofit to send to the people we paid money to.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I better get out and do it. So next morning I got up and I ordered them online. And then I started hearing about all the issues with the income taxes. And I thought, I bet there's nobody there to send that out. And I mean, and I haven't gotten it yet. And I ordered it like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things about like, this is really weird that the government isn't going to be able to collect taxes.
Right.
And so it's so self-defeating in a way.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think there's all kinds of things that will probably continue to bubble up and we'll think, oh, that they got behind during the shutdown, and you know, what is that? Some of it's irretrievable, probably.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to watch, I mean, you're talking about how we, the whole story, the stories of people, the government workers who have been affected really personally by this, that I think that this is a case where the mainstream media did a very good job of really pointing out the human cost of this.
Yeah, I do too. And I also think just because of how dispersed our media is now, there was a way to, it's not just, wasn't just in Washington, D.C., right? It was, there were people in, you know, every state that were affected by this. And I think they did a good job of sort of showing that. And then so many rural communities, sort of the best paying jobs are government jobs. And so it affects not just, you know, whoever's working for the Forest Service, but then it affects the cafe and it affects the gas station and everybody who's relying on these salaries to keep their small business running.
Another thing that was kind of telling was that a lot of these government employees are living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly why that is. I don't know how much they make. I mean, I think government employment is decent money. Mm-hmm. It's not like working for a Fortune 500 company. Yeah. But it was, in fact, Bill Maher went on a tear last week about how the middle class is shrinking. And yeah, that, and he was kind of comparing it, let's see if I can remember, I can't remember what he was comparing it to, but it was just an example of how these are things that are just kind of going away, and we have to, like, recognize that what used to be middle class doesn't exist anymore, and what we're calling middle class we would have used to call, like, struggling class.
Yeah.
And I think that that was something that, that was one place where I didn't see as good coverage of, like, looking at, well, why is it these people are living paycheck to paycheck? And I'm still kind of scratching my head about that.
I think everybody's living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, it's a very, I think it really, I thought it just really revealed, you know, so how fragile a kind of basic prosperity is for working people, and that working people are dependent on their paycheck.
I mean, what I felt like is we need to be a little more class conscious in this country and recognize that a lot of people that call themselves middle class are really working class.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if they could get their unions together, they'd be doing a lot better.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, like, I wanted to get back to something we touched on a little bit earlier, which is all the scandals. And how do you see that this, the growing drumbeat of arrests and indictments maybe is both affecting or possibly weakening the administration, but also what do you think it's doing for those of us who are sitting on the sidelines watching it happen?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, it's hard not to sort of like go wake up and go, it's Friday. I wonder what's going to, they're three arrows ahead of us. I wonder what's going to happen. But I also think it feeds our limbic system in a way that's not over the long term is not good, right? So we kind of get addicted to the scandal. And I include myself in that. And so I think that's I think in terms of the day-to-day tending of our civic and political lives, this sort of high stakes, high drama, FBI kicking in the doors of, you know, of people is not something that we A, want, or B, that is good for us. Because what over time what we need to be tending to is, as you say, climate change and natural gas and all the things that are, that take detail orientation, focus, tolerance for failure. So I think there's a lot of just the sort of high stakes drama of it all is, it feeds some of our worst impulses. And at this point, there's nothing we can do about it because it is what it is. If in fact there are people who are under federal investigation, they're going to get indicted. And they should. I mean, that's not inappropriate, but it's not good for us civically.
Well, you know, I was thinking this is probably, your memory of this wouldn't be quite as good, but Watergate didn't feel like this. I mean, Watergate, and also the scandal level was really small compared to what's going on. But I remember the Saturday Night Massacre, and I was actually at a pajama party that night, and we were all watching it, and kind of, you know, our mouths were dropping open. But it was very different. It felt, I mean, that was horrifying. And then there were things as Richard Nixon started to devolve that were heartening to us. And when he stepped down, it was very exciting. And actually, in the water, I remember actually I was working with kids then, and we would, and it was an early, a preschool program, and we'd come in and we'd turn on the TV and we'd all watch the Watergate hearings.
Wow.
But with you know, 7 and 8 year olds.
Yeah.
But they were getting it, and it was more like a time in history where we're watching this incredible process go through.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I feel like for the last, and I will go back to maybe the beginning of 2016 when Trump was on his ascendancy,
mm-hmm.
that we've been just kind of being dragged through the slime and the muck and the garbage heap for getting on 3 years now. It doesn't have the same kind of exhilaration as watching somebody who's done wrong get their comeuppance, because it seems like there's no way for these people to get their comeuppance.
Yeah, and I also think it's hard to, it's also just the amount of information, right? So it's both the level of the scandal and the number of people, but it also is just that we're just barraged with information. So it's not like, you know, it's not like you're getting your news source twice a day. Like, you know, I always feel, because I can't see without my glasses at all, when I wake up in the morning and I look at my phone and I can't really see what my phone says, but I can tell that there's a lot of news flashes, my stomach clenches, right? Like you think, oh my gosh, you know, what's happened? And it may be nothing. You know, what is noise? And I think we're just, the human organism is not well, it hasn't adapted yet to this amount of information. So it feels, you know, when people are like, the Mueller investigation's taken such a long time, you know, if you're thinking about an ordinary criminal prosecution with this many players, this much sensitive information, this many documents, it's moving at light speed.
Yeah, actually, Watergate took 3 years.
Right, right.
And they had far less to investigate.
But some of it is just what our expectations are, right? And I do 100% agree with you that we're kind of getting there's some numbing that's starting to happen, because you just think you can only watch the drama play out so much, right? And it's not good for us. I mean, we shouldn't be. To what end does watching at this level of detail?
Well, as I was picking up my iPhone this morning, I was remembering. Because I got my first iPhone in June of 2016, and I associate it I associate it with tracking that election, and at some point, I don't know, probably December of 2016, it was like I had such bad associations with that phone, I didn't want to look at it anymore.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a little bit better about not being so obsessed. During my cold, when I was, you know, I had very little energy, I did lie in bed hour after hour, sometimes reading all kinds of news stories that I hadn't given myself the luxury to read, and when I'm busier. And actually, I kind of felt when I was kind of funneling back into that news barrage and reading the same story, 4 different versions and things mm-hmm. like that. That's not a good place to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of, you know, part of weaning ourselves off of Amazon and Facebook. Also, maybe we need to wean ourselves off of this constant insatiable appetite for news.
I 100% agree. And I also, I think some of it is also we have no tolerance for boredom and just having to be able to accept the fact that nothing's happening right this minute other than, you know, what's right in front of us and what that might mean for governing, right? Because so much of governing is both detail oriented and dry, and I think we have to have some ability to live through that too, not just whatever's salacious and exciting and scandalous.
Actually, it'd be really nice to have a respite from the news. I appreciate it. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Portland poet and essayist Wendy Willis, author of a new book of essays called These Are Strange Times, My Dear. So what we should mention that you're going to be at PALS on Hawthorne on February 11th to do some readings from your book.
That's right. That's the launch, 7:30 p.m. at the Hawthorne PALS.
That's your neighborhood PALS,
right? My neighborhood PALS.
One of the things you mention a lot in your book is your zip code, which is the same as KBOO's, 97214. What do you feel is significant about living in this zip code?
Well, I know the zip code well, but it's a zip code I think that is not politically diverse, and so it's easy to start to think this is what the country looks like or the world. You know, when my kids were younger, they're teenagers now, but you know, their first political memory is John Kerry losing, and they just could not believe it. Like they thought this could not be true. Because they did not know a single soul who had not voted for John Kerry. And so to them, it was just astounding. Like, And I think still, if you ask them, they'd probably say it must be rigged because they didn't know anyone. And I think, you know, I think as we when we talk about the sorting of the United States and that there's so few places that are politically heterogeneous, I think our zip code, our dear zip code, is one of those places that, really is politically homogenous. And you start to think you know. And it also allows you to otherize people in a way because you are exposed to people with from different points of view on Twitter or television or whatever, and not at the grocery store or at church or at PTA.
Well, actually, back in 1972, when I lived in this zip code, which I don't live in anymore, I live in an equally undiverse zip code now. But I was astonished when George McGovern lost.
Yeah, see, right, yeah.
And that really had, I really had to be a little isolated because George McGovern didn't even take Oregon.
Yeah.
But I think that was one of the things that made me start to realize that I had moved into a bubble when I moved to Portland.
Yeah.
And though Portland was a blue-collar, working-class timber town still, I mean, it was certainly not the kind of really cool and hip place that it is now. But there was a very strong counterculture, and in that time, that was all I lived in Portland. I just disregarded everybody else. Mm-hmm. I think, though, even in Portland, I was thinking last night about, well, there's a number of other zip codes in Portland besides 97214 that are equally
yeah.
progressive.
Yeah.
And you have to really go a ways out of, into East County or maybe far out north, not even North Portland anymore. There's very few parts of Portland besides East County where you're going to find a different viewpoint than what we have here. And it makes me really think about how do we get beyond that and how do we, I mean, I guess maybe we could spend more time in Gresham. I'm not sure. But there seems to be, I know that I feel like I spend a lot of time traveling around Oregon and this year and going through Washington a lot, and that you do get a different sense when you're hanging out in Cowlitz County. You mm-hmm. start getting a different sense of reality. But I mean, do you think about ways to reach out more in your own personal life and find ways to connect with people who think differently than you?
Well, I have inroads, I would say, into other ways of thinking. I mean, some of it is the work that I do at Portland State, you know, statewide. So.
And what is that?
I direct a program called Oregon's Kitchen Table, and we work on getting public input into public decision making. And of course, that is everybody. And so that's a, you know, Oregon is much more politically diverse than it seems like they are from my couch just up the street here. And but I also, you know, I grew up in a working class town that people were Democrats, but they were working class Democrats. And so many of those people who would have been Democrats as I was growing up are now either Republicans or right-leaning independents. And they're friends, and I've known them forever. I mean, they're my, I think of them as my littermates, right? Like, we went to nursery school together and went all the way through high school together. And I've really worked to stay in relationship with people from my, you know, from my hometown. And there's times when it's been hard. But I feel like I'm not so shatterable that if somebody disagrees with me, I have to break relationship with them. I have to say to myself that the relationship is what's important. And even if I strongly disagree, even if I morally disagree, it's not harming me somehow to be in relationship. And so I'm trying to, I think there's a message, especially on the left, but probably in both places, that like if you have a moral disagreement, somehow you cannot stay in relationship with people. It's wrong to stay in relationship with people. And I just am really trying to not succumb to that. And I think people should do what they need to do. Like if people feel like they need to protect themselves from rhetoric and ideas that is hurtful to them for whatever reason, they should do that. But I'm not going to do that.
Well, I have this friend who grew up in Medford, and he still keeps in touch with a number of his friends down there. And I did a show a couple of weeks ago about Jordan Cove, and I found that he had shared it. And I talked to him on the phone shortly after that, and he had basically been sharing with all his friends down in Medford. And these are people that are Trump Republicans and very conservative, and he gets into lots of arguments with them on Facebook. But they all agree about stopping Jordan Cove. And so it made me think that there are these places with this common ground, and there might be ways for us to reach out to each other around things that we can all see are really bad for us. Maybe we see that they're bad for us for different reasons, but we can recognize that there's some evil forces out there in trying to push this on our community.
Yeah, and that there are things that just have to get done, right? I mean, even things that aren't controversial. That's why sorting is dangerous, because if you're in community with people who have to pave the streets and have to make sure that the schools are funded, then you're doing that together, and it has a kind of cohesion behind it, and there's a kind of it builds a sort of trust. But if you're so sorted that the only interaction, political or civic interaction you have with somebody, is over high stakes federal level decision making, then you don't have that sort of that underpinning to rely on.
Well, I learned the other night watching Bill Maher, actually, mm-hmm. that there's a lawsuit that a whole bunch of high school students someplace back east have filed demanding that their schools teach civics again.
Wow.
And I thought that's a very interesting point. I've had several friends going on ranting about the problem with this country. I had one of my friends right after Trump was elected, he said, the problem is that we don't teach civics. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, it's true that I'm old enough that I was taught civics, but I think it's been a really long time since it's been in the schools. What do you think about that as being a new movement to run with?
Well, I guess I'm in two minds, because I do know I really, really followed those Parkland kids really closely, because they were just so impressive. And they were so impressive from the very right after the shooting, like within hours of the shooting. And so I did a lot of reading about their curriculum, and their curriculum was a heavy-duty civics curriculum that Florida State University had been involved in developing for them. What had happened is Florida's bipartisan group of senators realized that Florida's civics education was some of the worst in the country, and so they're like, we're not having it. And so they really revamped the curriculum from grade school to high school. So when we say those kids were prepared, they were prepared. And they were prepared really intentionally because they had a civics education. But I also look at my own kids and their friends, and they are way more informed than I was. So I can, like, I had more civics in a really traditional way. But, you know, I did not know House members from other states, I will tell you that. And I watched them interact, and they were super active in the gun debates last year. And so I feel like I have a lot of faith in this upcoming generation. And so I sort of feel it's a little, I agree that I think civics is really important, but I also don't want to be too scoldy because there's some pretty impressive young people coming up.
I would agree. Actually, I have some friends, I don't know who they're talking to, but they're talking, well, these young kids and the millennials are just pathetic. They don't totally unplugged from everything. And I think, I don't know who you know, but the people that I know are amazing to me.
Yeah.
So there's hope.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's really impressive to me, I've been going to a lot of public hearings for different environmental impact statement hearings for the methanol refinery, the one built in Kalama, for the LNG facility in Tacoma, for Jordan Cove. And there's a lot of young people that get up and speak, and they cool. are so impressive and so articulate. So they're giving me a lot of hope.
That's very cool. Well, and just recently, this last weekend, actually, the Classroom Law Project did its We the People competition with high schools in Portland, which, if you have not seen, is an amazing display of young people who have learned a lot about the Constitution. And our two, I think Grant and Lincoln, I think Lincoln won and Grant got second this year, and they're going to nationals, and Oregon has a long history of winning nationals, so we're sending good wishes for them.
Actually, one of our millennial friends who graduated from Lincoln, I guess about 6 years ago, and she was on the Constitution team, and she went to Washington, D.C.
Oh, it's amazing.
And that was, I mean, it was amazing to hear how much she knew. I think she knew more about what was going on than I do.
And they're amazing.
Yeah. Well, we've got about another minute, and one thing we keep touching on but moving away from is climate change. And yeah. I just kind of want to frame that, because I think that is kind of the existential threat, mm-hmm. that we're even more so than Trump. And I'm wondering what thoughts you have about how we use that as a means to get ourselves refocused.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And for me, I feel like that's a place where we have to learn to live with discomfort, because I think in some ways we can say, you know, so-and-so's not working on it, the administration's not working on it, you can't talk about it, but some of it is it's just too painful to look at. And so if somebody gives us an excuse to look away from it, we look away from it. And so it feels to me like this is a place where emotional maturity and like inner work and spiritual work is very, very important to be able to face up to our own culpabilities and then our own futures. So it feels to me like this is a place where we can grow up, and we need to.
Actually, just look at some footage of the sunny day flooding in Florida.
Yes.
Gives you a real sense of what we're up against.
Yeah, it sure does, doesn't it?
Well, it's been really good talking with you, Wendy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and looking forward to your reading. Today we've been talking with Portland poet and essayist Wendy Willis, author of These Are Strange Times, My Dear, Field Notes from the Republic, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week we'll talk with political economist Paul Thier about some of the things that are wrong with the supplementary environmental impact statement for the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.
There are some folks I used to know, used to smile and say hello, spin the world and turn the page, entertaining from the stage. Father time forever true, loves its own and me and you, disappear just like the sun when the day is done.